Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
COVID and correctional facilities. We talk with the state's prisons commissioner on how they're faring. And summer is over, so what now for the state's arts and entertainment venues? We talk to Goodspeed Opera House to find out more. Plus, a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. Ever since COVID-19 broke out across the world and across the nation, government and state agencies have been scrambling to protect their workers and to carry on business. One sector, that of prisons and correction facilities, struggled initially to find the right middle ground on protecting not only corrections officers and staff, but inmates too. And very soon, our prison system was infected with COVID-19. Governor Lamont recently appointed a new Commissioner of Corrections, Angel Quiros, and I caught up with him recently via Zoom to find out the latest about the health and safety of the prison system. Commissioner, ever so many thanks for being on the podcast with us.
Thank you, Brian Scott, for having me this morning and updating your audience and the citizens of Connecticut on where we're at when it comes to COVID.
We want to touch upon that, Commissioner. So, tell us where the DOC is at with obviously COVID-19. Obviously, it's caused a lot of challenges, not only for you, but for many other agencies within the state as well. So where's the DOC with COVID-19?
As of this morning, I have a total of one symptomatic offender that's residing in the medical isolation unit in Suffield, Connecticut. To me, that's very important compared to phase one. Back in phase one in March and April, we were up to 189 at the very early start of COVID. And, you know, so for today, November 4th, to have one symptomatic in the medical isolation unit speaks on the work that we have done in corrections when it comes to being on the lookout for symptomatic offenders and providing the services they need. Different from wave one and wave two is the symptomatic offenders. Right now, as of this morning, I'm monitoring 34 asymptomatic offenders for COVID-19 around 5 correctional facilities. That still continues to be a concern. We have been testing, mass testing. We're in the third round of the offender population mass testing with the goal to end it in, I believe, next week, and then start on the fourth round of mass testing for the offender population. And to me, testing has been a key. Once we start doing testing in phase in wave one, and we continue to do testing every day in correctional facilities for new offenders that are coming in to the system in the county jails and quarantining them for 14 days to make sure that we're monitoring their vitals and any symptoms when it comes to COVID-related. Any offender who's being released back out into the community for a halfway house placement or transitional supervision into the community, those individuals are given COVID testing 3 days prior to leaving the facilities, and they leave the facilities with the results. If it's a positive result, then we suspend the placement until they're clear with the quarantine of COVID. We also do, when the offenders are transferring within the correctional facility from one facility to a second facility, we do COVID testing prior to the transfer. Any offender going on to the community when it comes to receiving medical treatments, specialty treatment, those individuals also COVID tested. When it comes to protective gear, PPE, I can tell you that we're such a better place when it comes to PPE. And I'll give you one example. In March of 2020, we only had 3,595 masks. As of yesterday, with the order that we got, we're over 200,000 N95 masks. So our supply is close to 120 days supplies on hand. And then the work that our health service unit, our medical staff are doing, it's been great. They were the reason that COVID, we were able to stop the spread of COVID on first wave. And I'm have my hopes that these individuals or our health service staff unit continue to do the great work they're doing to stop the spread of COVID-19 inside of correctional facilities.
I just want to put this point to you, Commissioner, and this is not a criticism of DOC, but, you know, is it fair to say that, you know, DOC, like other agencies here in Connecticut and across the country, were sort of put on the back foot a bit when this all happened? Because, you know, we saw a situation here in the state of Connecticut where, sadly, nursing homes saw a big loss of life. You know, you are dealing with incarcerated individuals, you know, enclosed. You have to obviously keep the security of, or the health and security of them, but also the security of the people outside on the top of your mind. So, you know, was this a big challenge? And, you know, is it, as I say, fair to say that really it caught everybody by surprise?
Yeah, I've been transparent about that. Department of Correction, every Department of Correction around the United States was caught off guard. We all have pandemic plans, how to deal with a pandemic. COVID-19 was just totally different. COVID-19 was a challenge. COVID-19 was a challenge because of the unknown of the disease. I could give you an example. At the beginning in Connecticut Department of Correction, our focus was on the symptomatic offenders. Who were the offenders that were showing any of the signs that they may be infected with COVID-19? Then 3 to 4 weeks afterwards, the asymptomatic population started popping up. So in Connecticut, we learned every single day, and we're still learning to this day, of really about the COVID-19 disease. And the good thing is that we've been following CDC guidelines, DPH guidelines. So every time those guidelines change, we adjust the guidelines to make sure that we're providing the best service. But it will continue to remain a challenge for any correctional agency because there's still some unknown. I feel very comfortable with Connecticut where we sit at because since March of 2020, our population has dropped over 4,000 offenders. So it's given me the room to social distance the dorms. You know, I got dorms in facilities at Carr Robinson and Willis Cybulski who are facilities that are dorm facilities at 50% capacity or less. So that allows for us to have the space, the social distance, allows for us to have the ability to quarantine the offender. But no mistake, COVID-19 is a challenge. COVID-19 is a challenge, and we continue to learn every single day of these challenges and trying to find ways to protect the offender population and our staff. One death is too many.
I just want to quickly move on as well, Commissioner, because we've got a couple of other topics we want to talk about. And this topic is with regards to visitation. It is back on now at correctional facilities. Just talk us through very quickly about that, because obviously that is, again, a challenge for you. But it is something that clearly people and yourself have wanted to obviously get back to some sort of normal.
Yeah, so it's very important for me to connect the our offender population with their loved ones. It helps with the anxiety. It helps with the stress. So on October 15th of 2020, we commenced with 11 of our correctional facilities with non-contact visits, 30-minute visits, pre-scheduled. We did not want, when we went live on October 15th, to have 100 people racing to a facility in the lobby. So everything is pre-scheduled. I can say that from October 15th, we've done over 1,200 non-contact visits. We're monitoring each facility to make sure there's no uptick in COVID. And so far, things are looking good, but we're still monitoring what's happening out in the community with the uptick in the community and to see where our next steps. When it comes to visitation, I had a meeting this morning with my staff this morning at 8:30 on video visitation, and we're targeting that. Hopefully, it's not a hard target date, but there's some flexibility for November 15th to start doing video visitation in 5 of our correctional facilities. And later this week, they will identify the 5 correctional facilities that would be doing video visitation. This is huge for the population. This is free for the loved ones. There's no cost to them. It's pre-scheduled and it provides the ability of those individuals that are incarcerated that have family members and loved one out of state that for them to connect. So this is going to be a huge move for us. COVID-19 did expose the Department of Correction with the lack of technology that we have. So it's my mission to bring Department of Correction up to a 21st century when it comes to utilizing the technology that's going to benefit both my staff, population, and then the loved ones in the community.
Fairly recently, you had an interview with another media organization in which you discussed that facilities would be closing in the next 2 to 3 years. Are you able to give any more clarity or any more information about, you know, when, you know, those closures will start to happen and which facilities that will be? Because as you said already in this interview, the population is down 4,000. So can you give us any further information on those closures?
That's a million-dollar question, and I'm going to stay on my grounds. Before I go public with the facility closures, I want to meet with the staff. I have a responsibility to meet with my staff and inform them of the decision that I've made and the reason I made the decision, and assure them that they will have a new work location to go to and work with them, work with the population too. I'm listening to everybody. I'm listening to my frontline staff of their concerns with facility closures. I'm listening to the elected officials with their ideas and their concerns. I'm listening to the family members with their concern, and I'm listening to the advocacy groups. You know, it's my responsibility as a commissioner to make sure that no matter how difficult it is for the criticism that Department of Correction may receive, that these constituents have a voice and that I listen to them. And then at the end, the hard decision is going to be mine of identifying those facilities that will close. I am looking for two in the budget year of 2021 and 2022, and then take a look and see where we're at with COVID-19 and see if there's more areas that we can close down for 2022 and 2023. And I will promise the media that as soon as I meet with the staff at those facilities, that the next move will be to do a press release on the facility closure.
So just a quick final clarification point on this. My understanding is that there are 14 correctional facilities in the state of Connecticut. You've already said that four of those facilities you cannot close, one of those being York in Niantic because it's the only female prison. So if that's four that you can't close, that means that there's 10 up for consideration. Would that be correct?
All 10 of them are on the table, and for me to review, for me to see the what are the positives, what are the negatives, what population could be moved around, where do I need the beds, do I need medium security beds, do I need minimum security beds, are the beds that are empty or a high level security beds. So that's the information that I look into that is going to drive which facility closure will be closed. So that's part of it. And then and what's happening out in the community with COVID-19 will play a huge role too, because if I see an uptick in offenders coming back into the correctional system, I have to make sure that I have space for that population.
Well, Commissioner Angel Quiros, Commissioner of the Department of Corrections in Connecticut, thank you ever so much, obviously, for your time and for clarifying the points with regards to COVID-19 and the closures. We do appreciate you coming onto the podcast.
Thank you, Brian Scott. Appreciate being part of your podcast.
Although COVID-19 has affected much in our lives and the businesses around us, over the summer, many arts and entertainment venues in the region and the state took steps to try and provide entertainment programs out in the open to help bring in some revenue and keep their businesses alive. But now as winter draws in and cases of COVID-19 spike, causing a rollback of how many people can be inside a venue, the arts and entertainment world is having to look again at how it can evolve once more to stay in business. I caught up with Michael Gennaro, the executive director of Goodspeed Opera House, one of Connecticut's famous arts venues, to talk about the challenges his organization has faced and what the future looks like. Michael, good to have you on the podcast.
And thank you for having me. I'm very glad to be here.
Now, of course, COVID-19 has caused problems for everybody, and not only here in Connecticut, in the US and around the world. The arts and entertainment industry has been particularly hard hit because of the fact that, you know, musicals and the ability to get people inside is restricted by various protocols. Just how bad has it been for Goodspeed Opera House?
Well, I think it would say that it's kind of catastrophic in a way, just in terms of the fact that we went into the year, into 2020, believing we were going to produce 6 productions, and now we're producing none. So you can imagine the impact that has had on our budget alone. It's a loss of somewhere between $5 and $6 million on an $11 million budget. And the impact on my staff has been palpable and profound. And you can imagine how many people, how many performers and creative people, directors, designers we had employed that now are no longer employed by Goodspeed for 2020.
It is, of course, extremely sad, but not only sad, as you say, it is for everybody concerned, not only the organization, but the people, just catastrophic. You have managed to try and pivot to some degree. Certainly, you've had experiences and events outside during summer. How did those go?
So we were able, with a kind of skeletal staff working on reduced hours and reduced pay, we, of course, you know, figured we have to keep our presence in the community. So we created a couple of online events on Tuesdays and Thursdays called Great Speed and In the Office, which were looking back at older productions that we've done with some people who are in those shows, as well as on Thursdays doing introducing our audience to new composers, new lyricists, new writers. And in addition, because we've got so much property in terms of buildings and land, especially since we're down by the river, we decided to try and do lawn concerts. And we worked with the state to make sure that there was social distancing and that we created safe pods for everybody. And we brought in a couple of musical bands who performed over a total of, I think, 8 weekends or eight four-show weeks. And it was very successful. They were basically sold out to about 140 people. People have already asked us if we will continue doing them when the weather turns better again. I think what we learned is that even when we're performing as we used to do in the Opera House and in Chester, I think we could still do these because they were so well received and they're kind of, you know, they work concurrently with the other shows we're doing. So we've been able to do that. And we also did an online gala, which was about 2 weeks ago, that was in and around the Opera House, everybody being careful and socially distanced and in rooms by themselves. And that was very, very successful. I think we had over 1,200 people watch it online.
That's amazing. And, you know, all credit obviously to you and obviously the team at Good Speed in being able to move in a different direction with all of these strict protocols, which obviously are causing problems not only for you, but other select venues where you just cannot have an amount of people, which clearly means, and you've pointed it out, Good Speed has pointed this out, that you can't have the usual high caliber sort of like musicals and other productions because it's just not cost effective.
Yeah, and in our case, you know, some of the other theaters are fortunate because they have a history of doing straight plays. So it's easier to do a one or two character play and make sure that everybody's safe in doing that as well as for the audience. In our case, a small musical is probably, you know, 12 to 15 people, and then you have an orchestra, and then you have all the people backstage. And in the Opera House, which is a little jewel box of an old theater, it's just, there's just not enough space. And with the current phase two rollback of restrictions, you know, when we perform, usually it's for 400 people at the Opera House, and to perform for 25, you know, there would be that many people on stage and backstage, and that the financials just don't work, really made it even a bit more difficult.
We want to talk about that again in just a moment, but I know that Goodspeed yourselves sent out a survey about a month or so ago to people who obviously have patronized Goodspeed and your other facilities and, you know, and obviously have enjoyed the productions, asking whether or not they would be interested in coming back to another venue, which I believe is called the Paint Shop, because you're able to basically arrange seating and social distance. What was the sort of reaction to that survey?
Well, yeah, we thought based on the lawn concerts, we have a very big facility called the Paint Shop, which is just one big, huge warehouse space where we paint all of our sets. And we thought we could bring people in there. It has very high ceilings and we could make it comfortable for people to come in. And we sent out a survey and probably only 25% of the people who responded said they would be comfortable coming back in. Now, hopefully, you know, with the good news that we've heard today about Pfizer and their vaccine, maybe sooner than later in the next 6 months, there'll be a little movement towards people feeling more comfortable. But right now, people are just, you know, if it's not outside, they kind of shying away from it.
The other thing, of course, is you put on productions, or before COVID, you put on many productions per year. And of course, as the holidays approach us, you know, there will be holiday themed productions as well. What's happened there?
Well, we have tried our best to figure out what we might be able to do holiday themed. And we were looking at trying to do something similar to what we did for the gala in terms of staging our own, producing our own event that we could show online. But the time now just is getting too crunched. And because I have such a small staff, we just couldn't figure out a way to pull it off.
Now, you mentioned just a moment ago about phase two. Sadly, we have seen figures, COVID figures, going back up here in the state, and the governor has decreed a rollback from phase three to phase two, which means that more stricter protocols go in force again, which again causes problems for organizations like yourself because it puts you backwards again on how many people are allowed inside a venue. You must have obviously not relished that news. What can you do about it? Is there anything that you can do?
Well, I must say, you know, one of the things we're lucky here is Connecticut is probably one of the leading states in the country for addressing the COVID problem. And the governor's done, I think, an amazing job of keeping it under control. And we when we did the lawn concerts, we had a lot of conversations with the state on what we could do or could not do. And they were very helpful and supportive. So right now, I think it's probably because we're getting close to the holidays and, you know, everybody's trying to restrict people's movements and travel. And I think it makes good sense for us just to pull back. And, you know, if we can do anything online, great, in terms of some small reaching out to our members. But I don't think there's anything we can do right now.
Clearly, there is money being made available to various organizations, whether it's federal money for payroll or if it's like state money. Can you tell us what sort of money is sort of available to your particular industry sector? And, you know, is it enough to help out at all?
Well, as you know, there's been multiple proposals made in the federal level, which have not panned out. We'll see if that's something changes in 2021. The governor did come up with a supportive stimulus program for the theaters in Connecticut. Really, it's for all performing arts venues and educational organizations. And it's a $9 million pool that you apply to. If you apply, you can get a grant, I think a minimum of $5,000. And then you can match more money above that and get larger grants. I think the difficulty is that money's coming from the CARES Act. And of course, there's so many worthy and needing organizations and that need that money. And there are so many, you know, performing arts venues and performing arts organizations and educational organizations in Connecticut that I think the amount of the pool probably can't allow it to give any sizable grants to some of the bigger organizations. I may be wrong, but an organization with an $11 million budget, as generous and great as it is to receive $5,000, that can only go so far. Whereas a smaller organization with, you know, only a couple of employees, that can mean a lot in terms of healthcare or something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, $9 million sounds a lot of money until, as you say, you put it into perspective. And there are just so many worthy organizations here in the state alone. And $9 million just doesn't go far at all, does it? Final point I want to raise with you. You are retiring now from your position. Is it a little bit bittersweet, especially considering the circumstances we're all facing?
Well, I could have never imagined when I announced to the board that I would be leaving. I announced in November of 2019? Yes, that I would be leaving at the end of 2020. I never imagined this would be the way that I would complete my almost 50-year career in running arts organizations and being involved in the arts. What's hard is not seeing the people, the creative people that you get to work with, not seeing the audience, not watching the birth of a show. I mean, those things are really hard to recreate in any other form, but you know, it is what it is and you try and make the best of it.
I can hear it in your voice. It obviously pains you greatly, obviously leaving behind these people. And as you say, at a time when, you know, it seems nothing more can be done because of this continuing situation with COVID, it's clearly very difficult.
Yeah, but I think we've navigated through this year very, very well, better than most. And I think we're setting up 2021 to be at least in the positive gain moving forward. And I think by the time the pandemic is under control and we get into 2022, I guess it'll be, right? I think Goodspeed will be in a very good position to prosper.
I have no doubt. It's been around for a long time, and under the direction of you and obviously the great team, it will survive, and obviously with the patronage of the people here in Eastern Connecticut as well. Michael Gennaro, Executive Director of Goodspeed Opera House, it's been an absolute honor and pleasure speaking to you today. Happy retirement, even under these circumstances. I mean that sincerely. And thank you, of course, for joining us on Connecticut East.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Stay well and stay safe.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently. In the Connecticut Examiner this week, the Connecticut Siting Council, the state agency tasked with balancing the costs and benefits of locating new infrastructure in the state, voted 3-1 to approve a scaled-back version of a proposal to build a 75-acre solar farm in Waterford, previously rejected by the council back in 2018. The planned solar farm will be constructed in woodland just east of the interchange of Interstates 95 and 395, less than a mile from the Nyanta River estuary. In the day this week, Jamie R. Gomez, the getaway driver in the 1995 gang-related murder of Darryl Watley Jr. in New London, has paid his debt to society in full about a quarter of a century sooner than expected. Gomez, now 48, was found guilty of murder at a trial in 1997 and sentenced to 50 years in prison. But his conviction was overturned in June by the state Supreme Court, which returned the case to the Superior Court for a new trial, in which Gomez was allowed to plead guilty to the lesser charge of conspiracy to commit first-degree assault in exchange for a 20-year prison sentence. Judge Hillary B. Stragbin sentenced Gomez to time served, since he has already served 24 years. In the Norwich Bulletin this week, concerned over possible maintenance and liability issues, Killingley Town Council recently declined a new offer to take ownership of several East Killingley Dam properties from a private company. The unanimous vote came after an hour-long executive session dedicated to discussing the proposal by Right Investors Services Holdings, Inc., or WISH, to cede ownership of five dams at Killingley Pond, Eddie Pray Reservoir, North Alvia Chase Reservoir, Bear Hill Road, and Acme Pond, that sit on 561 acres in East Killingley and make up the headwaters of the Whetstone Brook. The council's decision marks the second unsuccessful attempt by WISH in 6 years to free itself of the dam properties, some more than 200 years old. In the Middletown Press this week, a University of Connecticut police officer is accused of stalking and harassing two school employees. 54-year-old officer Peter Zavickas was arrested on a warrant charging him with stalking, electronic stalking, computer crime, and harassment, the Tolland State's Attorney Office announced. Zavickas, a 17-year veteran of the University of Connecticut Police Department, allegedly followed the two employees of UConn's Division of Public Safety in his car and used the university's statewide camera system to monitor their movements. Zavickas was released on a $25,000 bond and scheduled to appear in Tolland Superior Court. And in the Chronicle this week, Eastern Connecticut State University's emergency medical technician class worked with the Willimantic Fire Department recently to provide students with a hands-on learning opportunity. This is the first EMT class at Eastern, and the faculty is working to provide students with as much practical experience as possible. And in next week's Connecticut East this week, the election came and had few real surprises here in Connecticut, but it didn't go to plan for everyone. Here in Eastern Connecticut, 43rd District and incumbent Democrat Representative Kate Rotella lost to the Republican Representative Greg Howard. We talk with Howard about his campaign, his win, and his thoughts on working with an even stronger Democratic legislator. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow, and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott Smith. Thank you for listening.